5002. And I will call up. House Bill 5003. You'll call up Katie Koba, the Department of Agriculture Director. Good morning. Good morning. Suit, Katie.
Thanks.
Representative.
Saw case two.
Thank you, yes.
You look very nice this morning, Senator.
What's that?
You look very nice.
I think the whole committee looks
nice. I appreciate that very much.
Yes.
Yeah. Clem, where's your tie?
I had one on opening day.
Okay, I'm going to get in trouble for opening this hearing, and this is what's going to be on the record. So
yeah, exactly.
You've lost control already.
I've lost control already, so welcome.
Oh, there you go.
Somebody was watching.
Oh. We just opened the hearing, Mr. Chair. We were afraid you might have gotten waylaid on the freeway.
You ready? Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. We have 3 days to get through our budget presentation. It's a very simple, straightforward budget. Should not be a problem at all. So I'm going to do the best I can to get through the information. And when we were here earlier in the session and gave our agency overview, the committee expressed an interest in an industry overview, which is something that we typically do with our budget presentations. So today my plan is to get through our industry overview, and many of the issues that we talk about in the industry overview are actually factors that drive a lot of our budget, so it fits nicely into some of our budget driver issues. Then Monday I'd like to get through our performance measures, and Tuesday through our budget packages, and then next Wednesday is public testimony. So that's the goal. And with that, I think we get started. You heard from me Monday night a brief little bit in terms of the industry and the fact that it really is doing quite well. In 2004, we hit a record breakthrough in that farm gate value broke the $4 billion mark in Oregon, and net farm income broke the $1 billion mark. In 2005, we saw farm gate values continue to rise, but that was really the year that we got hit with a number of cost issues, a wet spring, if you all remember, which drove a number of pest and disease challenges for the industry and just being able to get things planted. And then that's really the year that we started seeing fuel costs rise. And in our industry, fuel cost increases also spill over into fertilizer costs as well. So we had net income fall between 2004 and 2005. The official 2006 numbers are not yet in, but we expect prices, farm gate value to continue to rise and costs to continue to rise, so pretty similar on the net income side. And this is a nice graphic that shows back to 1985. If you'll remember Monday night, I mentioned about agriculture has just had a steady contribution in terms of output and to Oregon's economy. And you can see that trend line, the top line, is farm gate value, sales of farm products. And then the bottom line is the trend line in terms of where we end up with net income. So the big chunk in the middle represents costs between the net income and the farm gate value. But at least the trend lines are going in the right direction, and we are still seeing net farm income increasing. If there's one word that I try to leave with anyone about our industry, it's the fact that it is so incredibly diverse here in Oregon. And the diversity of our industry brings opportunities and challenges. The other issues, again, many of them I mentioned Monday, the issue around land and land availability and the things that you're grappling with, both in terms of Oregon's big picture land use system as well as Measure 37, have a huge impact on agriculture. Water availability, as I said, I think we are going to continue to see more and more pressures on water. And you will see some slides later this morning that just shows how important water is to agriculture. We spend a lot of time thinking about our markets, and I look at it as a three-legged stool. The local market is very important for our industry, the domestic market is important for our industry, and the international market is also very important for our industry. And we need all three legs to that stool. We've got to maintain the existing markets that we have, and then we have to continue to constantly be looking for new market opportunities for our products. We've heard a lot lately in terms of workforce availability, legality, and cost. It is a huge issue for Oregon agriculture, and we are very hopeful that the federal government can deal with immigration issues here relatively soon. And then the latest buzzword in the industry is sustainability. Oftentimes we are asked just what does that mean, and it oftentimes depends on who you talk to. But for our industry, conducting business in a sustainable way is absolutely critical. It's the only way we can continue to survive. And that truly means in terms of the economic benefits to Oregon, the environmental benefits to Oregon, and the fact that agriculture is part of our culture, and it has been for a long time, and I would expect that that will continue to be for a long time. So agriculture is just a little bit different than, say, high tech, a little bit of a different cultural connotation. Who are Oregon's producers? In Oregon, we have 40,000 farms. Over 98% of those are family operations. And you can see the statistics. They could be individuals, sole proprietorships, family corporations, but a predominant family-based agriculture in Oregon. I like this slide because once I walk you through it, it really does characterize what Oregon agriculture is like, and the fact that that middle, the straddlers, are the places where we're seeing the most pressure on industry in Oregon. Full-time operators of those 40,000, 2,250 operations produce 80% of Oregon's agricultural output. So those are the big production areas, and again, predominantly family farms. They are only 6% of all farms. They manage 42% of acreage, but again, produce 80% of Oregon's agricultural output. Then let me jump to the bottom chunk. The part-timers, the lifestyle operators, the martini farmers, those kinds. These are people that have acreage. They view agriculture more as a hobby. It's certainly not their full-time job. Oftentimes their sales are less than 10,000. Their target is the farm stands, farm direct, some farmers markets operations. They are 69% of Oregon's farms. They produce less than 2% of the total output, and they control about 13% of the farm acreage. So it is indeed small, but that's where the vast pure numbers are in terms of producers. So the middle area is the place that is, I think, facing the biggest challenge for our industry. Sales between 10,000 and 250,000, oftentimes you've got one spouse member, if not both, that have to work off the farm as well in order to make their ends meet. They represent 25% of farms, they control 45% of acreage, and they have 18% of output. And so these are the people where we're either seeing them, if they want to stay in farming, have to figure out a way to get bigger and jump into the top section, or they're reducing and moving into the bottom section. And this is where a lot of pressure is, I think, on our land use system. People.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What you just described worries me in some ways almost more than many things in Oregon that we're facing. And I'm not sure yet, I'm not sure if I'm worried for the right reasons, but what I think is this. What you said a minute ago about the culture of agriculture in Oregon versus the culture of high tech in Oregon, I'm not exactly sure what you meant by that, but I'm thinking you meant what you just described. And the loss of those family farms, which is that middle group, even if they move into the bigger farms, I think changes the culture of not just of farming, but the whole culture of what Oregon has always been. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, a little more about what that dynamic means for Oregon, and then a little bit about how your department, what your department does relative to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Avakian, you've hit on the area that we worry a lot about, how to keep those folks in the middle viable. And if we lose them, what does it mean for Oregon agriculture? Just to remind you, even the big guys, again, typically are family operated. They are just aggressive, successful, have done a variety of things to be that way. So what we are looking for in that middle section are ways that we can we can get additional sources of income to the farm. This is a place where, frankly, we think renewable energy has some great opportunities. If you can put a wind tower on some of your acreage, you can still farm your acreage, and yet you are getting additional income from that wind tower, and it helps take some of that pressure off. My guess is that a big chunk of those in the straddler section have put land, at least in eastern Oregon, I know, into the Conservation Reserve Program. So there you've got, I know because my family has done the same thing. My brother runs our operation. He works full-time out of the house. My sister-in-law works full-time out of the house. We have put quite a bit of our acreage into the Conservation Reserve Program. That's not bad, because then that helps a lot with some of our environmental issues, the habitat issues, what we're seeing in terms of wildlife coming back into the countryside. So I don't believe by any means that all is lost here, but I think it takes some special focus and work with this section to figure out what can we do to continue to bring income into their operation so that they don't go away.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question about that? I don't want to get too far afield from the budget piece of this, but I'm glad to hear you say that maybe you're doing some proactive things to help save that tradition. But do you get the sense that we're really in a transition period where we're seeing the extinction of those types of farms in any significant way, moving to something else? Or do you really see a way to keep that segment viable?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Avakian, I truly believe there is a way to keep that segment viable. There's a joke in farming, you know, I reckon if I won $1 million, I'd just keep on a farm until it was all gone. And people that are in agriculture, I mean, it's multi-generational. They just, a lot of times you look at them and think, what in the world are they still doing farming? But you got to give them credit for that. So they're committed to it, and I think this is a place, for example, with farmers markets, with Farm Direct. Some of you are familiar with Representative Clem's bill to help focus on farm-to-school opportunities, farm-to-healthcare, direct things. We think there are opportunities for this section of the industry to take advantage of.
Mr. Chair,
just a comment. I mean, you're going to talk about water, but water can make a huge difference with those straddlers. I mean, for our farming operation is in that straddler. And you know, we're probably not going to expand, but if we could put water on it and increase the value of the thing, it would
be helpful. Mr. Chair, that is another good point. Adding value. So if you're a wheat producer, what can you do to add value to wheat to make it not just a commodity? And former Judge Laura Pryor, she'll always be Judge Laura Pryor to me, has worked so hard in Gillum County to create the physical infrastructure to allow the wheat producers there to segregate their wheat and market their wheat based on certain protein qualities and other qualities of the wheat. It's the first time we've seen it in Oregon. It's things like that where we think we can add value to commodities, or if you've got water, then you take land before that couldn't grow, especially seed or a vegetable or something that can have a higher return, and then you've got more opportunities.
Katie,
this is in regards to Measure 37. That slide up there explains, if you look under the bullet under the part-timer's lifestyle, explains why over half of the Measure 37 claims are filed by farmers with 40 acres or less. That is the reason we're having such a tough time with Measure 37, because these are the people that no longer can farm profitably, and their only alternative is to try to develop the property. And that's what we, with regulations, have forced them into that position. Thank you.
End of sermon. I'm getting a debate here. Representative Clem.
You were quiet up until with regulations part at the end. But
okay. Representative Clem.
I was looking for strike three. So
I mean, there is some truth to that comment that there are pressures on costs of compliance and labor and everything else.
Sure.
But the question is, do you solve it by having people sell to a full-time operator at a lower cost than full pavement and condos, or help them get back into a profitable situation with Stradlers? I mean, my particular situation, and some of you know this, is we did have a full-time operation for 80 or 90 years. And I quit my job to go up there and be full-time operation. And for the first year, that worked. Then our income, and we were grossing just over $250,000. Yeah, that's right. Net was, you know, was pretty good. It wasn't certainly $250,000, but $70,000 or $80,000 maybe for a bunch of family members to all work part of the year, and at least two people to work full time. So you made maybe $30,000 or $35,000 a year in as an individual if you're working there full time. And then after a combination of things, trade agreements, you know, I felt in our industry, at least on the pairs, costs, labor costs, you know, spray costs, $70,000 last year just in spray, 50% energy increase on our orchard last year in spray, in expenses. And now we're in the Stradler. So my father-in-law said, you know, you're not going to get a paycheck anymore. You're going to have to help for free now. So I said, okay. So I went into high tech and I started my computer business as a way that I could take 2 or 3 months off and just go work for free in the orchard, and then my customers all know that's where I disappeared to every fall. And so now we're Stradlers, where, you know, my wife and I both work, her cousins work, we all do what we can, but it's difficult. So we tried doing a little fruit stand on the apples. That worked pretty good. It's a lot of work to harvest all week and then go do fruit stand on the weekend. So, you know, it is difficult. And all my neighbors filed Measure 37 claims. Now, every single one of them says we're not going to actually do it, but it's an insurance policy. If the state doesn't change some of the incentives or find help for the Stradlers, then someday we will. But, you know, we didn't, because I just don't believe that I'm not ready to give up and even put that insurance policy in place yet on our place. I would much rather come down here. It's one of the reasons I ran for office, frankly, is to come down here and make agriculture more viable so we don't have to go down that road. But paving it and turning it into condos is not the only option. There's conservation easements. There's buying development rights. I mean, there are other options the state has. And that's why I begged to get on the Measure 37 committee, much to most people think I'm insane. But, you know, this is really, really important. You know, this slide is perfect, and thank you for keying in on it.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate you allowing this conversation to go on a while, because it helps me in understanding what the mission of the agency is with respect to these parts of Oregon. And when we get down to performance measures and policy option packs and whatever else you've got, this kind of background I just think it's helpful. So,
I want to clarify one thing here, because it at two different levels, the full-time operators and the part-time lifestyle. I think somehow we've gotten this characterization, and you corrected that a little bit, that these are all large corporate farms. And to me, $250,000 in gross sales is not a particularly high figure, particularly since I know a lot of people probably with $250,000 grosses aren't netting $70,000.
Yeah, now it's about 10 or negative 30 sometimes.
So can you give us a little bit more an idea about who the full-time operators are? And while I agree to some extent with Representative Girard on the part-timers, I think actually some people have chosen, because I've known people that have chosen to have small farming operations and still keep their outside employment. And that's what they intended to do from the very beginning. So,
Mr. Chair, I think the part-timers lifestyle folks may have filed Measure 37 claims, and who knows why. I can see why the Stradlers would have been a majority of those that would have filed Measure 37 claims just to keep their options open. If they can't make it, then they have that as an option. But the full-time operators, I can use a number of examples in Eastern Oregon. Kent Madison, for example, who is really on the cutting edge of a lot of the biodiesel work, has partnered with The city of Portland is growing the biggest amount of canola in eastern Oregon. It's the Madison family. It's a family farm. I think he's got about 17,000 acres that he runs, and he would fall into that full-time operator place. But it's a long-time family that farms in eastern Oregon. Senator Nelson can reel them off better than I. One of our board members, Bob Levy, who's also in that area and is a partner in American Onion. It's a family operation partnered with another family. So these are people that, for the most part, they're generational farmers. It's been passed down in the family. A lot of it sometimes is luck. Having the land in the right place, I have no idea why our ancestors stopped where they did and picked the crappy soil that we're on. But, you know, those that are closer to the Blues or in central Oregon and can do specialty seeds, those that made it to the valley, the best farmland oftentimes that you'll find in the U.S. So there's a factor of things, but it is true that those full-time operators are family farms, even though they may be an incorporated farm for business purposes.
So I remember in portions of Marion County, and I'm sure it's true in much of the Willamette Valley, you've got farm operations where there may be a base farm, but they have literally multiple acreages in different locations, and it's not a contiguous farm as the outside world might generally view a farm as being this large entity. So,
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
I stirred some conversation here with Representative Berard, and then
I'll just
get
let you guys complete your presentation. How's that? I'll flip the page, and then you can talk about it.
One quick comment that I think Director Kobach agrees with. Many of those farmers came and farmed on crappy soil because the federal government told them they'd give them all the water they needed.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gard, in some places that's correct. We don't have water on our land either.
Okay. Well, I guess we can get started here. Before.
Ready?
Yes.
As I mentioned, 220 different commodities produced in Oregon. This definitely gives you the steady growth that we see in the industry, because you could have one commodity that may be doing poorly and other commodities that are doing very well, and it just evens out what we see happening in agriculture in Oregon. But this diversity presents its own set of challenges, and trying to speak for the industry is one big, huge challenge because there are so many differences. It's not just due to geography, product mix, market, what have you. Oregon's top 10 products. We've all heard the story about nursery and greenhouse. Leapt into number one probably close to 10 years ago now. Hasn't looked back. Cattle and calves at number two, and then you can read on down the list. But here you get a snapshot of the diversity of the industry. Pears are still on the list. Representative Klein, number 10. And then comparing that to this, this is the area where Oregon is the number one producer in this certain commodity. So on this list, there are only two items that are also in Oregon's top 10, and that's grass seed and Christmas trees. Of course, potted forest azaleas are a subset of the nursery greenhouse. But here you can see, again, Dungeness crab, a number of our seed products, hazelnuts. These are all places where Oregon is the number one producer in the nation of these products. Another one of my favorite slides. Four of the top five producing ag counties in Oregon are in the Portland Metro Willamette Valley area, and 6 of the top 10. A lot of people think agriculture is an eastern Oregon phenomenon. It is not. Now, then there's a different dynamic. In eastern Oregon, it tends to be much more a higher percentage of the overall economy. But in terms of the success of the industry in Oregon as a whole, it is all over the state. And also, again, Representative Garrard, the challenges with making this happen.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I was embarrassed during the last session when I found out that Washington County has more cattle than Klamath County. To illustrate your point.
That's true.
Oh, Marion, why don't you do something about that?
This is another fascinating slide. It's a new slide for us. Basically, it breaks down the land that we have and how it is used. So if you go immediately to the bottom, you see that 27% of Oregon's land mass is characterized as agriculture. Cropland represents, and that's 17 million acres. Cropland represents 5.5 million of that 17, and then the remainder is woodlands that are in ag ownership, so it's oftentimes farm that has trees on it as well. And then by far pasture and range land, the largest segment at 9.3 million, and that is a huge piece in terms of the environmental side of the benefits of these lands to Oregon's environment.
First question, Katie. So can I assume that as far as irrigated lands, what percentage
we
of
will
that?
We'll get to that. Okay. I've got a slide on irrigation. If you don't mind waiting.
Yeah, no,
we get
I was
there.
Just curious, out of the 17,000 million acres, what percentage was irrigated?
We'll get to that.
I know Katie Fast always comes in and says it, but I don't have it memorized yet. A few more times and I'll have it memorized, Katie.
In terms of the cropland, you see it comes down fairly much in order. Hay at the largest at 1 million acres, followed by wheat, 980,000. Nursery and greenhouse, number one commodity, 50,000 acres. So again, you can see the higher value, specialty type crops, doesn't take as much land. Conservation Reserve Program represents about 500,000 acres in Oregon. And here you have a graphic in terms of the breakdown of all Oregon land. Half of it is under federal ownership, the agricultural piece at 27%, commercial forest at 19%, and urban and all other 4%. We've talked a lot about the importance of the contribution to Oregon's economy. Not only do we have sales, but farmers produce or purchase inputs, machinery, fuels, fertilizers, et cetera, over $3 billion in goods and inputs. Value-added processing, we'll talk a little bit more about this, absolutely critical to the success of Oregon agriculture. The two are linked so closely together, represents $2.1 billion in revenues to the state's economy, $2.5 billion in salary wages. Agriculture is a key traded sector. We rank first in terms of volume of exported products and third in terms of value of those exports.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You don't have to go back on the slides, but linking this back to the slide we spent 15 minutes on earlier, if that middle section does dissipate into the bottom and top sections over time, do you anticipate this changing?
If enough of them go into the top section, this will continue to grow, because it is the top section that does most of this generation to the economy. If you see those, I think the bigger challenges are if they're out of the business, you would assume the bigger operators are taking that land, but it's really what is happening to that land, what are the conflicts, you know, if it's developing between people that live out in ag lands and what we need to do to farm and ranch. But again, I think, I can't remember, 80% of the farm base is that top group.
If I understood your answer, I think your answer is as long as that land stays in agricultural production, these numbers should stay the same or grow. If it changes to development, then you might see this affected in a negative way for agriculture. Is that what
Chair, Senator Vakian, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If my read on this is right in terms of studying some of the history in other parts of the country, the one danger potentially in that trend is if the straddlers sell to the full-time operators, family, that's true. If they sell to sort of, you know, major mega corporate farms, still there's going to be production, but profits will leave the state back to corporate HQ rather than stay with the family who's going to buy all their trucks and everything here, you know, for personal use. And that's and we haven't had, you know, a lot of that, but that's what I always watch for.
That's absolutely correct. We've gone through a lot of this. I think bottom line, in sum, agriculture and food processing comprises approximately 9% of the state's gross state product, 8% of jobs, and 7% of value-added manufacturing. Employment, more than 167,000 people are engaged in a variety of occupations related to agriculture, again, 8-9% of Oregon's employment. Food processing, as I said, it's absolutely critical to maintain our food processing base in Oregon. It's been an area that has been under challenge in the last decade. We've seen a number of food processors leave the state, but we're starting to see some innovation and new food processing come back to the state, which is very good. Interestingly enough, Multnomah County leads Oregon in food processing with more than 22% of the food processing payroll and 20% of the employees, followed by Marion County. Where our products go. I talked about the three-legged stool and the local, domestic, and international markets. The fact of the matter is 80% of what we produce in Oregon leaves our state's borders. 40% of that moves into an international country. So for us, we have got to be cognizant of markets around the world and what is going on in those markets and how we can continue to compete in all the various market segments. Agriculture accounts for 19% of all state exports, 60% of the Port of Portland's total tonnage of exports is agriculture. And as I mentioned before, ag rate ranks third in value and first in volume. Another busy slide, but I think a fascinating slide. You see the top markets, international markets for Oregon ag products. The list of the countries is on the left. Japan has been our top market for many, many years. And then the first column of numbers is the raw agricultural value exports that go to those various markets. So with Japan, $474 million. The box in the right is a list of examples of what those raw products are. So it's wheat, vegetables, seeds, fruits, grass, straw, nursery. And then the second column of dollar value is the processed product value. So you see Japan is our number one market in both in terms of raw agricultural products and processed agricultural products. South Korea is second in terms of raw, fairly high with processed, and with the new, assuming it gets ratified, free trade agreement with South Korea, we think that's a huge opportunity for Oregon agriculture into that market. We've been active in South Korea for many years. Moving down, you see Canada is actually second behind Japan in terms of processed products. And the UK is third at $24 million in processed products, but not much raw product goes to the UK.
Here.
Are the live animals cattle?
I'm getting a nod from the back that yes, the live animals are cattle. We do have some horses. Former Senator Hartung was very active with our agency in thoroughbred horse trading into South Korea, I believe. But that's pretty small. Water. 45% of all Oregon farms do some irrigation. 62% of the cropland acres are irrigated. Oftentimes the two go together. So the five million acres in cropland of that 62% are irrigated. And then I think the most interesting factor is that irrigated farms produce 77% of the total value of Oregon's harvested crop. So it just highlights the importance of water to agriculture. And when you can apply water to land, you can do a lot more with it than when you can't. I mean, Hermiston area is a classic example. Very, very sandy soil. If you don't have water, it's sagebrush. If you have water, it's onions and potatoes and vegetables and wheat and canola and absolutely.
She making your case for you?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
We're waiting for all the Senator Nelson.
Wonderful job. I just hope you guys are soaking this up. Oh, Senator Shields.
You're sitting in a seat, I think. That's
I've gotten a signal from the back. Total irrigated land in Oregon, 2 million acres. Going on about water, there's a lot of talk about needing more water in the state, and I think we need to talk about the fact that agriculture has done some incredible efforts around water conservation, and really that centers on technology and being able to apply technology to how water is applied to the ground in order to use less and less water. Center pivot irrigation systems, they actually use 50% less water than traditional flood systems, 25% less water than older style pivots. So places where the industry can make investment in this new technology pays off in terms of water conservation. Drip irrigation systems, 33% less water use than pivots. Probably the most amazing drip irrigation system I've ever seen is the Poplar Plantation in the Boardman area, all drip irrigated. And the, you know, the amount of infrastructure and hose going out to each one of those trees is unreal. And then when you can get into variable frequency drives on pumps, you're also conserving electricity.
That should help Representative Dingfelder, conservation.
Mm-hmm. Environmental contributions. We can't lose sight of the fact that when you've got land in agriculture, production and rangeland, it has great environmental benefit for the state. Again, reviewing 40,000 farms, 17 million acres, 27% of Oregon's land mass. We provide food and habitat to over 70% of the state's wildlife at different times of the year. The industry has done an incredible amount of work in dealing with erosion tied to trying to improve water quality. We've seen that erosion on cropland and rangeland has been reduced by more than 23% in the past decade, and we're not stopping there. A lot of effort going into water quality and trying to continue to improve that that number. We actually have, believe it or not, a reputation for being a national leader in natural resources management. Our agricultural water quality management plan, Senate Bill 1010, first state to do that. I don't know of any other states that have actually tried to take that on. We're very proud of that. Our confined animal feeding operation system here in Oregon, all CAFOs are, if they're federal CAFOs, and that's a trigger by the number of animals that you have, are registered to the national NPDES, I won't even say it, permit. And we actually go a step further in Oregon. State CAFOs, these are CAFOs that fall under that animal number, meet the same standards as the federal CAFOs do. And again, Oregon is pretty unique in that, and that is something that the industry has taken upon themselves. So when we inspect state CAFOs, they must meet the same standards as federal CAFOs. Oregon leads the nation in the number of water transfers and amount used for conservation and wildlife, and two different numbers there. A lot of land involved in conservation programs. The 500,000 we had seen in Conservation Reserve Program, we have Wetlands Reserve Programs and others. And I think that's an area where we're going to see additional opportunity, not necessarily in CRP, but I think having incentives to producers to do certain environmental things on their land, but at the same time keeping it in production, I think is an opportunity for those straddler sections. Can't leave without talking about energy and agriculture's role in that. We've been working on renewable energy in the state. Certainly the efforts that this legislature has put into additional opportunities, I think, are going to be huge for agriculture, and I said it the other night, I believe that we are seeing a monumental change in agriculture now around renewable energy, not just for those who employ things on the ground, grow canola, put up wind towers, use microhydro, put in methane digesters, but we're already seeing a changing dynamic in terms of prices, wheat and corn prices at all-time highs. That's good for wheat and corn farmers. That poses challenges for the livestock industry because that is a cost for them in trying to feed cattle. And so things to be worked out, I think, in the future. We are already a leader in wind energy. When I go home now and I see the transformation of wind farms throughout eastern Oregon, it's a pretty amazing sight. And we continue to try to adopt methane digester technology on dairies. They are becoming more common. There are technological challenges still with operating methane digesters. So, summing up global trends and what are really kind of the six key issues driving what's happening with Oregon agriculture. the fact that we are in a global economy and our producers compete in a global economy and market into a global economy, and we're seeing consolidation in wholesale and retail food channels, it just means less places for producers to go, and oftentimes you have to be bigger to get into those wholesale and retail channels. The other option then is the direct marketing. If you're not big enough to get into a Safeway or a Fred Meyer or a Tesco in England, looking at a New Seasons, looking at farmers markets, which are obviously growing in popularity, opportunities around direct marketing to schools or to health institutions, I think has a lot of potential. Number two, we talked about it. We can't not put it on the list. Escalating expenses, fuels, feeds, fertilizers, workforce, machinery. I said it the other night. In order for Oregon farmers to be competitive in a global economy, we cannot do it on a cost basis. We have to be smarter, and we have to employ research and innovation. Research and innovation, absolutely critical to our future. Number three is a big one. We haven't talked about it a lot yet. But we will be as we go through our budget. The global economy means not only are people and products moving, but so are pests and diseases. And we see it in agriculture, we see it in forestry. Huge impact with invasive species. When you look at the federal USDA and the huge growth in their Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, just trying to combat pests and diseases, it's not going to go away. It's only going to get tougher, and it's just a fact of life. And our goal in our agency is to keep bad things out. If we find them in Oregon, to eradicate them before they become established. That means an upfront investment, but certainly the cost upfront is a lot less than if something becomes established and the impact not only on production, but the whole landscape. Changing consumer trends. We've got to pay attention to these and market our products in order to take advantage of those consumer trends. One of the big areas that we are seeing, and we've got a package surrounding this, is on certification. Anymore, everything is certified to something. Salmon Safe, Live, Food Alliance, good agricultural practices, good handling practices, Europe Gap. It's all certified. Consumers like to see that. Organic, probably one of the first certification programs. And we want to be in a position to help the industry take advantage of these marketing opportunities.
I needed one clarification on the certification. Well, I've obviously seen many different types where it's used in terms of expectation from consumers. Have there been any restrictions put by any importers in terms of certifications where it's not just simply a... It's not simply a consumer expectation, but someone has put a certification requirement in terms of receipt of or importing products?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we are seeing that now. Europe Gap, for fresh fruits and vegetables going into the UK, they do now require any fresh fruits and vegetables coming into that market to be Europe Gap certified. So we have producers who are Europe Gap certified. Ken Bailey, Orchard View Farms, a cherry grower in the Dalles, who's a board member, is Europe Gap certified. He moves cherries all over the world, but had to do that in order to keep moving his cherries into the UK market, and we expect that trend to grow. Number five, new technology. I can't stress this enough in terms of being smarter than the competition, taking advantage of technology. We didn't even get into a discussion of genetically modified organisms, but that's big in the industry, and it causes a lot of debate around GMO products and other kinds of things. But again, for Oregon agriculture, frankly for U.S. agriculture, technology and technology advancement is where we can really excel. And then number six, population growth, competition for land and water. And Senator Vakin has left, but more and more as we talk about air and air quality impacts, we just know that these are going to be issues that are going to be challenges for the industry.
Just quickly, Katie, you know we've talked about this before. I'm a founding member of a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, and And it's been amazing watching the growth of membership in CSAs around, at least I'm familiar with the Portland metro area, and the farmers market. I have a farmers market right in the heart of my district. It's just packed pretty much from the time it opens until it in May until it closes in October. So as far as your early slide with the straddlers, my sense is this has been a huge market for that section of agriculture. It's folks that, you know, it's not large farms, it's these small family farms. The people I talk to at our farmers market, they're like, this, we would be out of business if it wasn't for these farmers markets. So can you talk a little bit about the growth in those small, the contribution that's had in you know, keeping a certain sector of agriculture viable, and then what you see as the growth potentials, and then what the department's doing to foster that sector of agriculture?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, it's both the straddlers but also the part-timer lifestylers, and Representative Clem, as he indicated, put himself in the straddler category. A lot of those part-timer lifestylers use those outlets for their product as well. And it fits into number one in terms of, if you can't get into the big wholesale retail places, where do your products go? And that is a growing opportunity for Oregon agriculture, and it's wonderful to see. It's also wonderful to see from the standpoint of it's a connection place for urban and rural Oregon, and a hopefully a better understanding and a desire to keep agriculture viable in Oregon. But you can't lose sight of the fact that it's 20% of what we produce in Oregon. And so for our family operation, I think for Senator Nelson, the same thing, it also depends on the mix of what you can produce. I would put our operation in the straddler category, but it's all wheat. So a farmer's market is not a viable option for us in terms of alternatives. For us, we're looking at the conservation side, the energy side, diversifying in that direction. So, it depends on what it is that you're growing. Representative Clem talked about the fact that he's in the straddler category but sees farmers markets as an opportunity. I think for fresh fruits and vegetables, the farm-to-school program could potentially be huge. What we're seeing in terms of interest in healthcare organizations and wanting to source direct and local, another great opportunity. But again, it depends. If all you're growing is cherries, I think the figure I have is we'd have to Oregonians would have to increase their consumption of cherries 18 times in order to consume all cherries produced in Oregon, and I wouldn't recommend that we do that.
I love cherries. Well, just to follow up, my point is that the department track, and I know you have folks who work directly with the farmers market. It's just at some point I'd like to see, you know, what that growth is, and I know it's not in numbers, you know, as far as going to be competitive with some of our, you know, like you said, wheat growing or some of our export crops, but as far as keeping local family farms where they may not have another option. And that's just, it's more anecdotal when I talk to the farmers in my market. They're like coming from Gresham, from Canby, from all over in there. That is what's keeping them alive versus selling out to developers because they don't have other choices for operations. So I'd be curious just to see, you know, if you're tracking as far as the amount that's coming in through farmers markets over time. I don't know if CSAs have to register with you or how you track that.
Well, you want to come up maybe and just speak a
little
bit.
But we can talk offline because it's you got to keep going, so you can just follow up with me. That's fine.
I'll represent men.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add a little more because I think this will help you understand sort of what the straddler is in the fruit, tree fruit and berry industry. The people who are in farmers markets who are not part of co-ops, and that's all they do are farmers markets, they're kind of size-wise acreage in what you would consider the part-time category, though they may actually be doing it full-time, and that's how they are making their living, is the farmers markets. What mostly you've got in the straddler category, though, is my situation and a NORPAC grower where their gross may be $250,000 around there. That's going to be 80 in tree fruit. That's going to be 80 to 100 acres. You're going to be talking, for us, 1.5 million pounds of pears. So on my farmer's market, I can do it all fall long, pears, apples, and I can only move 16,000 pounds that way.
Now that adds in some income, but I still got $1 million, you know, for. And so we're not set up to do any of this stuff is the other problem, because we've been in co-ops for so long, and all of our grading and packing and cold storage is all up there. So the co-op upped the percentage in ours. They upped the percentage that you're allowed to do outside the co-op if you want to try and help the straddler. But we don't have cold storage outside the co-op. So on December 31st, if you haven't moved your stuff, they shut down the cold storage and say, okay, you're out. And, you know, I just take it to the food bank at that point and write it off. And it's just a problem. We just got too darn much to be doing all farmers markets. And so you either get smaller and sell to, yeah, Ken Bailey's my neighbor. You know, you sell some to Ken to add into his 1,000 acres, and we cut way back and just do farmers markets. But then the co-ops will go under too, and you won't have cooperatives, and then some other growers will be forced to sell to the bigger guy as well, because you've got, you know, no cold storage, no packing, no grading. And I really want to find ways for the grower to stay the grower as much as possible, but find ways to get the middleman out a little bit. And that's kind of farm to school, where you can still grow a million pounds if you just feed some of these more commercial uses without having to get into the, I mean, I almost think of it as kind of the boutique situation. But, it, you know, it's a challenge. And I like what I'm hearing. I think some of our program option packages will assist greatly. And that's where we should target our efforts, I think. Mm-hmm. Edgewater, you got the straddlers that you need to help figure out how to move a million, you know, quite a large volume, really.
We are ready to move on to our real budget presentation. So from here on out, we're going to do everything in your binder, which is in front of you, and we're going to go to tab 2, and the first thing we need to do is we have a replacement graph, which is a piece of paper on front of you, and if you just rip out your first graph under tab 2 and replace it with the piece of paper that should be at your desk, and under the Oregon Department of Agriculture tab. Back to a quick snapshot of the agency. Again, we were in front of you. It was in January. That's, I'm sure you remember everything that you heard and how we are structured, but just in case any of you are like me and I can't remember what I did yesterday, a quick overview. We have two graphs. One, the first one is revenue for the agency, and the second on the back side of that is somewhere here is expenditures by division. So revenue, we are predominantly an other funds agency, license fees and those kinds of things that support our programs. For the 07-09 governor's recommended budget, 19% general fund, and you can see the associated dollar values of what that means down below, $18.8 million general fund in the governor's recommended budget, 13% lottery funds, the majority of that is Major $66 that go to soil and water districts, our insect pest program, weeds program, that kind of thing, and then 5% federal funds. And then the back side of that page, you see the expenditure column. The major difference in that is really on the other funds side, because where we have any balances coming in, and we don't use necessarily all of those license fees, but very similar to the revenue side. A reminder again of the divisions that we have in the agency, and you can kind of get a picture in terms of how big they are. We have 8 or 9 divisions in the agency. Our plant division is our largest, 22% of the budget. That represents $18 million. This is all funds, followed by natural resources. And let me go back. Plant has, that's our pest and disease program, keeping out weeds, bugs, diseases, nursery and Christmas tree inspections, certificates that they need if they're to be exported, all done in the plant program. Natural resources at 14% of the agency's budget. This is our Senate Bill 1010, the Ag Water Quality Program, the Confined Animal Feeding Operation Program, our Soil and Water Conservation Districts Program, field burning, all in our natural resources division. Commodity inspection is 11% of our agency. This is a lot of our quality grading for the industry. Pears, apples, cherries, onions, potatoes, what have you. And this is also the area where we do some certification work. Good agricultural practices certification, good handling practices certification, and if we get more involved in certification, these would be the folks that would actually be conducting the certifications. Pesticides program represents 8% of our agency. This is all of the licensing of pesticide applicators, both commercial and private applicators, the registration of all pesticide products, investigations, the PARC program, the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, housed in pesticides and part of the pesticide use reporting system, the new system up and running as of January 1st in the pesticides division. Animal health and identification. This is where we deal with the livestock side, the beef and dairy industry. One section of that is the disease side, keeping out animal diseases. Should include poultry and any other livestock that we have. We have goats. Did you know we have a big goat farm in Eastern Oregon? I had no idea. Anyway, BSE, when we had the BSE scare, we handled that out of this division. Our state vet is housed here. Our avian influenza plan, West Nile virus, all of those kinds of things in our animal health and identification division, as well as our brand program. Anytime there's a sale of an animal, it goes to this program to make sure it's a legitimate sale and not a stolen animal.
Sure. Let's not us forget that we also have buffalo.
We do have buffalo.
Yes.
Are they free to roam?
No.
Yeah, we got a fence about it.
So we have goat and buffalo.
I was going to say something.
I set you up.
Our food safety division. Food safety issues have been hot in the news lately, from spinach to lettuce to pet food. Our food safety division inspects all processing facilities and retail food establishments where more than 50% of the sales from the retail food establishment are not from delis. If you get into 50% from delis, then it shifts over into health, and health does restaurants. But we are doing what we can to keep our food supply safe for the consumer. Our measurement standards division handles all weighing and measuring devices in the state, makes sure that they are licensed and accurate, also handles motor fuel quality, and we will be involved in the new biofuels package. We will be the ones monitoring production of biofuels in the region, and when it hits the trigger, we wave the flag, and then all of a sudden the mandate for biofuels kicks in, and then we will also be doing the fuel quality piece for on the biofuel side in our measurement standards division. Laboratory services used to be a separate division. We've rolled it into our admin services, and this is support, the lab support for our various programs. We do pesticide testing, food safety testing, shellfish testing, all in our lab division. You know what I missed? I missed forces driving our budget, didn't I?
We're going to do that afterwards.
Okay. And so maintaining our technical expertise in our lab is absolutely critical. Our agriculture development and marketing division, I always have to point out it is our smallest division in the agency and taking on a lot of effort, working on the whole notion of the moving products into local, domestic, and international markets, supporting the industry and finding opportunities for markets and for development as well. We get involved in food processing issues, keeping food processors competitive, helping to recruit new companies to the state. And then our admin and support division represents 10% of our agency.
Okay, quick question before you go into the budget drivers. Under federal funds, and I apologize, I'm still in the restroom. Is CRP and like the Wetland Reserve Program, any of those included in here in the federal funds, or that's a separate, is that through NRCS, so it's not included in here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfeller. Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. All the federal payments go through NRCS, okay. Do not come through our agency.
So that's additional money that comes to farmers or comes to the state, but it's not reflected in your budget?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Our federal funds, a lot of it is our plant pest and disease program. We get gypsy moth money, for example, to do gypsy moth eradication work, grasshopper work. How many federal funds do we have? Federal funds and pesticides program. So animal health program, we get federal funds in to do particular disease control work.
And just remind me, because it's been a few years since I was at the SWCB, there's a state match for like the CRP, CREP funds, or is that the private owner, landowner match?
Madam Chair, there is not a state match for CRP. It's all directly feds to private landowner. Okay, we ready to go on from...
Representative Burley has a question.
You've mentioned the gypsy moth. What's the status of that little critter over in Central Oregon?
For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. We are preparing to do an eradication program for gypsy moth and Asian gypsy moth. We had a find in the Bend area as well as one north of Portland with the Asian gypsy moth, and that should be taking place this spring. We just received some of the federal funding to start those projects.
And thank you. Is it BT in both cases?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, you are correct. It would be BTK in both cases that we would use as the pesticide for those eradication projects, which is what we've used in previous eradication projects as well.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to tab 3, forces driving the budget. I'm not going to go through all of these in detail. I was jealous when I was listening to the Water Resources Department presentation and they had 5 issues, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I've got too many. A lot of these, as I mentioned, we went over in the slide, and really the forces that are impacting the industry are a lot of things that drive our budget as well. In our agency, our mission statement is threefold: to promote the economic development of the industry, to protect the natural resources base, and to provide consumer protection. And really, in our agency, what we're trying to do is minimize risks to the extent we can for the industry and to maximize benefits. And that is done through all of our programs, and it is done in a regulatory manner as well. We try to outreach and educate the industry as much as we can in terms of how to meet regulations so they don't get in trouble. If there are problems, obviously we deal with those as well. But a big kind of overarching theme is this notion of minimizing risk and maximizing opportunities. In ag development and marketing, I've spent a lot of time on it, this whole notion of where our markets are and paying attention to those markets, the three-legged stool, local, domestic, and international, and the challenges that we face with industry diversity and trying to meet and help a diverse industry with our agency. Commodity inspection, the first bullet, demand for alternative inspection services that are audit-based. We're seeing this notion of audit-based inspection everywhere we turn, and it is beyond just commodity inspection. But no longer can we have a man standing on the line watching all the cherries that go through. It's just not cost-effective. It doesn't make sense. So what we're turning to more is educating the producer themselves or the processor themselves in terms of the quality pieces and the grading, and then we come in and do an audit, kind of a base performance on their processes and spot checking the line, if you will, to make sure they're meeting that audit basis. And that's what we're seeing happen in the private sector as well. So ways that we can have efficiencies but maintain that effectiveness of our program.
Senator Buckingham.
Back to the bullet point right before the one that you just talked about, with regard to markets, there seems to be a trend in this body to weaken or eliminate some of the commissions that were specific to certain agricultural products. What's your opinion on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Avakian, I'm glad you asked that question because it's that's not really what's happening. In the case of the Bartlett Pear Commission, they are also involved in the Northwest Pear Bureau, and in that situation, I think it's right that it's more of a regional marketing effort for Oregon and Washington pears together. So basically, we're abolishing the Bartlett Pear Commission, but the producer assessments go to the Northwest Pear Bureau, and the marketing punch there is going to be greater. In terms of the Western Oregon Onion Commission, we are just seeing onion production on the west side of the state falling off. The acreage is going down. They just got to a place where it's a very small commission. It doesn't make sense to bring in the monies to that commission. Most of it is spent on, you know, the part-time executive director that they have, and I think they just felt they would pursue other avenues for marketing their product but not have the assessment and support a commission. So I don't think these are bad cases. Moving on to animal health and identification, animal diseases. You will hear it over and over again, whether it's animal diseases, plant diseases, invasive species. Just the movement of product and people brings new things in that they come in on RVs, they come in ships, and we do everything that we can to maintain our disease-free states. With tuberculosis, for example, BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, avian influenza, and having plans in place to address these things in case they do come in. I think there are diseases that spread more rapidly than a BSE would, and that would really be my worst nightmare if we had a foot and mouth outbreak in Oregon, because then we're seeing the slaughter of major numbers of animals, and it's not a pretty picture. So we don't want that to happen here. We are also spending a lot of time in our agency around biosecurity and homeland security, the concern that a terrorist act or even a non-terrorist act, something that could happen in the food supply that would have a very negative, devastating impact on not just agriculture, but people as well. So we do work on that in our animal health division as well as in our food safety division.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
On that point, is there a coordination with any other state agencies?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Vakian, absolutely. Absolutely.
And they are. Okay, I'm sorry. The you name them answers it. A comprehensive, comprehensive coordinated state effort.
There you go. Beautiful. Good answer to your question.
Yeah.
Health Department, DEQ, I could go.
OEM,
absolutely. We're part of the team. Let's put it that way. Moving on to food safety. Again, they're dealing with biosecurity issues. Foodborne illness outbreaks, it's been a concern of ours forever. It's unfortunate when we have outbreaks that raise consumers' attention to these issues, but Listeria, Salmonella, been around forever. We do everything that we can with industry to prevent those outbreaks, and it's, as I said, it's just unfortunate when we do have an outbreak. Lettuce in California, for example, spinach in California impacts Oregonian producers, even though that was not the source of the outbreak. So I think, particularly given the widespread issue with pet food, there's a lot of focus at the federal level about how to better coordinate federal efforts around these issues as well. I think I heard the statement sometime there's like 11 different federal agencies that deal with food safety, and there's been discussions about trying to streamline that and consolidate it. In Oregon, I guess the good news is there's two. There's health and ourselves, and we try to work very closely with health on these issues. That being said, again, globalization of the food supply, wheat gluten coming in from China in the pet food case, new microbes, norovirus, a new, fairly new microbe that impacts what we do, and we can see that in food as well, and just trying to stay on top of that is a big challenge for us. In our measurement standards division, just the increase in number and the complexity of weighing and measuring devices, how we deal with online commerce when it involves weights and measures, these are challenges for our division. They are a nationally recognized division. They do a lot of work to maintain their credibility and their instrumentation, if you will. They're part of a national lab system, so staying on top of that is very important. And then the role that, that our Measurement Standards Division will play with biofuels. Lab services, I mentioned. Everywhere we turn, people are wanting more and more the technological backup, the analytical analysis, the scientific analysis. Maintaining our ability in our lab, our technical expertise is absolutely critical in it. We do our food safety sampling tests there, our pesticide tests, a number of things in our lab division. The back page, natural resources. Confined animal feeding operations and air issues. It is a big deal for us how operations that are smell, how they interface with people that are not used to living around smelly things, and what we can do proactively in our agency to help site new facilities coming in the state to minimize those potential conflicts. And we've been spending a lot of time on that issue. This really came to light when we had a producer that wanted to move from the valley to Hermiston, and some locals were concerned. We spent a lot of time with the Hermiston community. That producer is not going to go for different reasons. It didn't work out business-wise, but trying to put in place a system to help the industry be successful, site in places that will work for them and have minimal impact on neighbors. And just in our CAFO program, that is keeping manure out of water. That's the whole goal of the program, and you'll see later in our performance measures, we do a pretty good job. One of my favorite lines when I come to work is, do we have any manure in the water today? We usually do. Not for CAFOs.
It's a city of Portland issue.
Yeah. The nice thing about working in agriculture is there's a lot of, you know, things that we can talk about in day-to-day work and use ag connotation. Another favorite thing of mine is, you know, believe it or not, manure doesn't flow downhill. It actually flows uphill. I think you guys feel that all the time. Our Senate Bill 1010 water quality program, we have now all plans in place in 39 around the state, and we are in full implementation mode. The Tualatin and Bear Creek were the first ones to be put in place, I think, 10 years ago. Great things are happening there. The last ones went into effect a couple years ago, so we're on the front end of those, but constantly working with the industry to proactively address water quality issues and hope to continue to see good trends in that area. And then finally, in natural resources, I think the increasingly important role of soil and water conservation districts, which are linked with our agencies along with watershed councils, linked with OWEB. They are working very well together, and there is just so much work to do on the ground. We rely on SWCDs to do our Senate Bill 1010 work on the ground, to deal with the coastal coho issue, with our other endangered fish issues. So we are asking SWCDs to do more and more work, and they're just a great link to the industry for us. In the pesticides division, these bullets were written a couple of weeks ago. The one that I would highlight now for us, front and center, is education and outreach, not just in our pesticide use reporting system, which is new, but in the pesticide program as a whole. We had a recent instance where we had some producers in Malheur County who inappropriately used a product. They have received civil penalties, and through that case, I think we need to put more emphasis on our agency in terms of education and outreach to the industry. The industry as a whole does very well. It's a highly regulated industry, but just to reinforce that we've got to use pesticides in the way that they are supposed to be used and protect that tool for the industry. So that's going to be a real focus for us in the coming interim. Plant division.
Silva, how long do you think it'll take you to get through the grant proposal when we get through this?
Through which proposal?
The grant proposal that we have to act on this.
5 minutes, and I'm 1 minute from being done.
Okay.
Plant division, invasive pests, disease, weeds, I can't say it enough, and the impact that it has on our agency now and will continue to have in the future. And with that, I will finish for today on the agency presentation. We'll start in on performance measures on Monday, and we can move to the two grant requests that we have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Department. The Department would like to request permission to apply for two federal grant opportunities. Grant one is a grant with the USDA Risk Management Agency. This grant will coordinate a project identifying agriculture producers that are not currently covered by catastrophic risk protection crop insurance. The due date on this grant is April 23rd for submission, and we anticipate it will be awarded sometime around September, which I think coincides with the federal fiscal. The second grant is through the USDA Ag Marketing Service. It's a Farmers Market Promotion Program grant. It is to augment a program that ODA is currently developing to connect Oregon schools to Oregon-produced agricultural products. It is due tomorrow, so that one has a very short timeline. It's in the amount of $75,000, and that one also we anticipate we will find out about that in September.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, LFO is recommending approval of the request to submit the two grant applications.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The line, last line under the recommendation or analysis is that there may be an additional request for additional federal funds expenditure limitation. Would that be through the e-board? If that comes through, or it'll be in time that you'd come back to this committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I believe you heard that they talked about it would be awarded in September, so that would be next interim. And typically the way we do this is we have the agency hold these types of things towards the end of the interim to look at their complete federal funds picture to see what the whole picture looks like and if they're using up all their limitation, and then at that time they would come in and request additional expenditure limitation, not only for this but for other new revenues if those were to appear during the interim.
Thank you.
Does the Department of Administrative Services have anything to offer? I'm trying to get them to say a word.
It's good to be with open my mouth, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, this is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend that you approve these requests.
Representative Dingfelder.
Would you like the motion?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the two requests that are before us from the Department of Agriculture. You need a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, to the full Ways and
Means. To the full Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Any discussion? There's a motion on the table. Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections to the motion, motion passes. Let's see. Senator Nelson, will you carry both?
Sure.
And with that, I'll close the public hearing, and we are adjourned for today.